The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry with Joe McGill.
Good morning, good morning. How are you this morning? I'm Joe McGill and you're listening to the Saturday Supplement. And I hope I find you well wherever you are listening to us around the world on RadioKerry.ie or on the traditional wireless 96 to 98 FM. Now, before I move on with the programme and before I forget it, following the world premiere in Los Angeles and the Irish and European premiere in Cork earlier this year, Carsevine tenor Gavin Ring, together with acclaimed pianist Louise Thomas, present the homecoming of Ballads of a Bogman, the Sigismund Clifford song cycle, a terrific work by composer Stephen McNiff, a new work based on the poetry of Carsevine Sigismund Clifford, on the 16th of October at the Daniel O'Connell Memorial Church at 7 p.m. And it promises to be a great night. The talented Gavin Ring, it's on the 16th of October at the Daniel O'Connell Memorial Church. Tickets are €20 plus booking fee. And for more on that, you can go to gavinring.com. That's gavanring.com. And of course, we are doing a special program on Sigismund Clifford next Saturday. So very timely indeed. Now, very busy programme as always for you this morning. Later on, we'll have our Kerry County Council Creative Kingdom, letting you know what's going on in the arts world. There's some great events and plays happening coming up over the next month. We'll be talking about those. But first, let me tell you about a little email I got here from Mary Casey. Good morning, Joe, she told me. This is a few weeks ago now. Firstly, let me tell you that I just love your show of a Saturday morning since I moved back to Kerry at the start of the COVID in 2020. It was as a result of listening to your show that I was inspired to encourage my 92-year-old father-in-law to write his own life story during the first lockdown when he was staying with us in Cleathan Linehan, that's over the water in Carsevine. Well, he did write it and he finished and we got it self-published. He was born in Tralee, the son of a member of An Garda Síochána, and therefore moved around Ireland. At 18 years, he worked in the Ulster Bank in London, then applied to go to Rhodesia, and at the age of 78, he returned to live here in Ireland in 2008, first in Dublin and now in Carsevine. Well, I was invited by Mary Casey to go and meet the man himself, William Lean, so I wasn't going to turn down that opportunity. So I went over the water in Carsevine to Cleathan Linehan and I met with William to talk about his new book and about his fascinating life.
In Rhodesia, I was always known as Paddy Lean, as most Irishmen in Africa are known as, yeah. And whereas it's look on being a derogatory name in Ireland itself, that's not the case in Africa. Any Irishmen are very, very, very well regarded in Africa because they're honest people and people of initiative. So anyhow,
tell us, where does your story begin?
I went to St. Eunan's in Letterkenny for the better part of my education. And that was because my father had been, I had been with the Patrician brothers in Galway, Nuns Island was what they called the place. And anyhow, then when my father was transferred up to Donegal, he had to find a school for me, and anyhow, I had to go to St. Eunan's in Letterkenny. That was quite a change for me because St. Eunan's was a completely Irish school. Everything there was through the medium of Irish, and also, of course, there was a lot of craziness going on at the time on the revival of the language, as I always say. There was so, I always say there was one particular teacher, a very qualified guy in St. Eunan's, and I'm convinced myself that if he had his way, he would have taught English literature through the medium of Gaelic. Yeah. So, but
have you any memories of Tralee?
No, none at all. No, no. The main memories I have of Galway, which I really grew up in Galway up to 1942, and that's the only place I kind of vaguely remember. Limerick, but no, I was too young, and anyhow, Galway is probably part of my formative years in many ways, because I went, my first schooling there was quite something. I went to a place called Scoil Ursa, and Scoil Ursa was one of these junior schools where everything is through the medium of Gaelic. So anyhow, that's probably where I got my good grounding in Irish, which did help me, although I did struggle quite a bit when I'm now trying to understand the special Gaelic they had up in Donegal.
How does a man from, you know, living in Galway and starting out, how did you end up in Rhodesia or Zimbabwe, as it's called now? How did that process happen?
Well, I'll tell you how. Well, anyhow, when I left school, eventually I got a job in the bank, in the Provincial Bank of Ireland, which is now part of Allied Irish Banks. And anyhow, about that time, there was a great manpower shortage in Southern Africa after the war, and there were a lot of recruiting campaigns on the go, looking for people to go to Africa. And one of the first things that I got interested in was, I can't say I liked working in the bank very much, although, yeah, I did learn a fair bit there, and at least I had a job. A lot of people didn't have a job, but the pay was pretty awful, and I kind of looked at some of the guys I worked with, and after 30 and 40 years with the bank, their only means of transport was a bicycle. They people in banks were not well paid. There was a hell of a gap, of course. If anybody got to be a manager, of course, well, all kinds of things happened to him then, and his situation improved quite a bit. So anyhow, my initial interview was with one of the people who are interviewing people for the mining industry. Now, I didn't say I understood the mining industry all that much anyway, but anyhow. So this guy said to me, well, you're the kind of a person we're looking for. You're well educated. Why did you join us? Now, I didn't know anything about mines in South Africa, really, he said, but in the end, we would help you to go to university and become a mining engineer. But anyhow, of course, the only thing I knew about mines in those days was a Rigna coal mine, where people were lying on their sides digging out coal on a continuous basis. But anyhow, when I now had to get permission, my mother said, not a chance, there's no way you're going down these ruddy mines lying on your side digging. She had no idea what the mines in South Africa, and neither did I have. But anyhow, that went flat. Anyhow, then the next thing I heard about the bank, Barclays Bank, DCO, they were looking for people to join them, and especially for people to go to places like the West Indies and the likes. But anyhow, I got a job with them, and I went to work in London. I can't say I was very well off there either. Things were not easy. But anyhow, it was quite amazing. A very landmark in London was Rhodesia House, number 429 in the Strand. And they always had pictures in the window there of, you know, various aspects of Rhodesia. And I can remember on occasions, you know, looking there, and they've got a picture there of a mounted policeman out in the bush. And I thought, God, that must be a bit of an interesting life. But anyhow, I was all set to go to the West Indies. And anyhow, Unfortunately, then there was a change in the immigration legislation, and nobody under 21 was allowed to be sent to work in the West Indies. They're now trying to get local people into jobs and the likes there. And anyhow, there was a friend that I happened to work with in the bank, and he had applied to join the BSA police. Anyhow, I didn't know anything about it, and he told me what it was, and anyhow, he had to go for a final interview on the thing. And anyhow, I said, well, why don't you come with me here? So anyhow, I said, oh, I'll come with you, all right. I said, but I can't go near your interview or anything like that. And along we went to the Strand. He went in to see the officer who was doing the interviewing, and anyhow, he came about. He was a little bit glum, and he said, oh, I wasn't accepted. The guy reckoned that I wasn't self-reliant enough, but anyhow, there it was. So he kind of walked out of where he was with the interviewing officer, a captain in the BSA police in a very smart uniform, and he said, oh, hello, who are you? So I told him who I am. And he said, well, what brought you here? I said, well, I came with this chap who said he was going to join the police. I see now he's been turned down. He said, well, why don't you join here? So anyhow, that's how it happened. Anyhow, one thing led to another. And the next thing I knew, I was accepted to join the BSA police, and I was going to go off on a boat from Southampton three weeks later. So things had to happen at quite a speed. And of course,
and just before you move on, had you any ambition ever to become a police officer? Because your father was, in Garda Síochána. Had you ever any ambitions? Yeah. No.
No, as far as I was concerned, what seemed to attract me at the time was this guy riding in the bush on a very smart looking horse, and thought, oh, well, you know, like.
And it was a boat trip then over. It was a boat trip.
Yeah, it was. Anyhow, that was quite interesting. But it took 2 weeks to get there. And met a few people on the boat. Of course, also, when I got onto the boat, there were six other guys who were in the same draft, as they called it, as me, who were going to join the BSA piece at the same time. Got a bit friendly with them. Anyhow, and eventually we got to Cape Town. So anyhow, that's where my books is more or less from arriving in Cape Town. And of course, after 2 weeks at sea, and then early one morning, you could feel the boat had now stopped, and we're just moving very slowly in the waves there, and looking out, and here's this great vision of Cape Town with this huge Table Mountain there dominating the whole place. And I thought, yeah, and I said, no, this is right in the middle of the southern end of Africa, and that's where I'm going, yeah. So anyhow, eventually got off there and got on a train and headed off by train up to Rhodesia. And that was quite a hot trip in many ways, because, it was a big train. There were two engines on it. The whole thing was about maybe a kilometre long, and it was loaded with people who were going to Rhodesia more than anything else. But it was a bit interesting.
William Lean speaking to me there about his life, which is in a new book, Finding Rhodesia.
You're listening to the Saturday Supplement with Joe McGill on Radio Kerry.
Now let's return to the interview I did with William Lean on his new book, Finding Rhodesia. And was it a big culture shock to you?
Oh, I wouldn't say so. You know, when you're young, you want to get out and see the world. It was no cultural shock, just a question of interested in new things and experiencing new things. I mean, on the way up by train, you know, you have visions that now you've been going through a wild part of Africa and you see all these elephants and giraffes and everything like that. It wasn't like that at all. You're now going through quite a settled area. I distinctly remember going through the great wine estates as we left Cape Town, and then of course getting up into the higher ground to see the extent of the farms, and they just seem to go on forever, and windmills seem to be the great thing, generating water, and lots of big herds of cattle and the likes. So very very little incidence of African population or anything like that. And eventually we got into what was Bechuana land in those days, now called Botswana, because that was the way the railway line went. And anyhow, that was a bit interesting, because now we more or less came across lots of African people living along the railway line and so on, and eventually we crossed from there and entered into Rhodesia, and after a kind of a long, a good long day's trip, or maybe a bit longer than that, we arrived in Salisbury, as it was, about 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening. Yeah, and anyhow, there we were met by a very smart policeman in uniform, and anyhow, he checked us all out, made sure that we were all there and the likes, and he says, "All right, come with me." So anyhow, we all, and of course, now we had our luggage as well, and he said, "Don't worry about your luggage, I'll sort that out." So anyhow, I must say it was quite interesting, because we went with him, and when we went outside, he ushered us into a mule cart. Yeah, and here's this cart, you know, with the seats in it and the likes, and it's been pulled by two mules. And the thing that really interested me was the lights of the thing were two candles in glass bowls on the front of the thing, which is very interesting.
You must have thought, where am I now?
No, I wasn't. Anyhow, I thought. So, anyhow, eventually we now get to the depot, and anyhow, we got shown our billets and the likes, and of course that was, you know, very much a and now we had medical exams, and got issued with uniforms, and anyhow, the accommodation there was in more or less prefabricated huts, as it were, that were originally brought in there in 1923 or thereabouts. But anyhow, it just shows you that prefabricated buildings went back a long way, and these had been manufactured in Britain and shipped out and then assembled in Rhodesia at the time. And of course, I did see a lot of these all over Southern Africa down through the years. Mm. So
now you go into amazing detail in the book, and we won't be able to get to all of it. Yeah. Because it is amazing what you can, you know. Yeah. Your memory is insane, the way you can remember all this. Mm-hmm. And in such detail. But what was it like being a police officer in that first period for you?
Well, the training was quite severe. Make no mistake, and there were a lot of aspects to it. And the biggest thing, of course, you had to be, you had to learn how to ride a horse and ride a horse properly. And then, of course, you had to learn how to use your weapons. You had to learn basic law, as it were. And one of the biggest things of the lot is you had to learn how to type, because the way things were in those days, any statements recorded by the police that were going to be used for evidence in court or anything like that had to be typed by the police, and then everything you handed to the magistrate was actually typed for him, so he didn't have to start typing it up himself or anything like that. But anyhow, that was pretty good. So anyhow, in my first station was actually in the charge office in Salisbury, as it was at the time. And of course, I was now mostly used to work, of course, the whole thing was on shift work basis, and the hours of work used to be 12 to 12, if I remember correctly, and like that. So anyhow, when I was on night duty, I spent a lot of time walking around the town area, as it were, seeing there were no unruly conduct or anything like that. Really, it was just showing a presence.
And was it a dangerous place at that time? What was it like? No?
No, not a dangerous place at all.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't. No, and the police were very well respected.
And within the force, was there many black people and white people? Like, was it a mix, or what way was it?
Well, you see, you had the African police actually were probably the major part of it. Because they were the ones who did most of the patrolling out in the rural areas, and they did most of the investigation of the crimes, you know, which were most of the crimes were what they call black on black. Then you got white on black, black on white, and so on. And that was the categorization of the. So anyhow, they're the ones who actually investigated most of the crimes. And then once they'd done their investigation, you now had to sit down and more or less question them, talk it over to them, and then record the statements which they're now going to submit in the court. Yeah. Mm. And it's quite interesting. When I got moved from there to a rural station, a place called Salukwe, which was a bit of a mining area and quite a good ranching area, in other words, where people had herds of cattle on their farms. Anyhow, it was quite interesting. The magistrate there in those days was an Irish guy. Quite amazing. Never forgotten his name. I mean, his name was Lindsay Fawkes Seymour. And he was a graduate of Dublin University. Yeah.
You're listening to the Saturday Supplement with Joe McGill on Radio Kerry.
Now, I hope you're enjoying the programme so far. Now, let's go back to the interview I did with William Lean, the author of Finding Rhodesia, which, of course, is now called Zimbabwe. And this is his life story. Did you enjoy your time as a police officer?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. No, I didn't. Not really. Because the way I looked at it, the life of people, when you got on and you now went to small rural stations, which was quite isolated in many ways, and you know, you're dealing with all kinds of silly domestic things in many ways. But anyhow, I got myself quite a good name for investigating crimes. I studied a fair bit myself at the time as well for the actual investigating manuals and the likes. And anyhow, I was then offered a position in the CID, the Criminal Investigation Department. And anyhow, I was sent off there. Well, I was taken aback because when I now had to move to Bulawayo, and of course, I'm now straight away employed in the Fingerprint Bureau, because that was the first thing I had to learn, or one of the things you had to learn was all about fingerprinting, yeah, you know, which was always a major part of it. And it was a very interesting work. I worked with some very interesting people. It was quite amazing. One of the guys that I worked with then, at that time, who was a sergeant, he eventually became the commissioner of police, a chap named Peter Allen. And anyhow, while I was there, I thought, no, that's not this is not the life for me. And in the CID, one of your main jobs seemed to be checking on the doing the rounds of the pubs to see who was there, see if there are any. There was a fair number of international con men descended on a place like Rhodesia at that time, and anyhow, they were all over Africa, as it was. And anyhow, it just wasn't really mine. But Anyhow, I decided to leave, and I got sent back to Gwella, where I was now attached to the CID for my last 3 months there. And when I now thinking of leaving the police, what am I going to do? And a friend of mine came to me and says, you must have learned a few things. Why don't you go into the hotel business? Yeah. Anyhow, which I did. And I worked in a hotel. But, in those days, the main part of the hotel was a pub. And that was what seemed to be most of my life was in the place. And at the time there was also in Rhodesia compulsory military service. Yeah, everybody had to do their time in the army once a year. And after I now finished with the police, next thing I get a letter on the post telling me that I must go and register for my military service. So along I went to the local army barracks and said, I've come to register. And the chap said to me, what are you doing? I told him what I was working at the time, this, that and the other. He said, we're expanding this army in quite a big way. The Korean War was getting on to go at the time. And he said, why don't you think of us? Yeah. So went and did my reported to another barracks, and I started my 6 weeks training. And during there, that he said to me, "Look, why don't you join as a regular?" And in those days, they had what they called a staff corps, and that staff corps was based on an Australian system, whereby you had this team of specialists, as it were, who helped to train all the other people who were doing it on a temporary basis. So they mostly became known, they were the territorial army. But anyhow, because the threat of the Korean War at the time, of course, was very real. But I then went along with him, and he said, "Well, then the first thing you have to do is learn how to be an instructor." And so I now had to embark on another round of a year's very hard training. Make no mistake about that. It was really hard.
Why was it hard? What did you have to do?
Well, the times were, we started off on the drill square, and we had to be on the drill square at 6 o'clock every morning, yeah. And learning how to march and salute and do all kinds of other things to train other soldiers in drill was quite exacting. And then, of course, you had to learn all about your weapons, and that, of course, was very interesting. And, of course, a lot of this was through the medium of your own instruction. In other words, you'd kind of learn about one aspect of drill or something like that, and then you're told, "All right, now, tomorrow you're going to conduct that lesson for other people." So anyhow, that's how the thing worked all the way along the line. So anyhow, the weapons were very interesting, not just rifles, but machine guns and pistols and mortars and various things like that. And seemed to get a fair grip of those, and I got very good results on all those courses. So I was selected to do what they called an army tactics course. And tactics, of course, is the way our armies carry out their operations. And that led me to another course on that. And suddenly now I'm Getting myself into a groove where that's going to be my future, is teaching people about leaderships and army tactics and things like that. So anyhow, that's more or less how I got going. And in the meantime, I got promoted to eventually I became a sergeant. And of course, about the same time, I met my wife, and who actually was from South Africa. And anyhow, she was working as a secretary in Salisbury at the time. So anyhow, I must say we hit it off very nicely.
How did you meet?
Yeah. It was quite interesting. You know, in those days, the great kind of a social get-together, you know, there was no TV or anything like that in those days. And everybody was interested in hi-fi, high-fidelity, full-frequency range recording and the likes. And, of course, different people had their own ideas, so guys didn't have their own special TV, but different ones had their own special hi-fi equipment or something like that. And I was quite friendly with a French guy, a guy named Montocchio, and... anyhow, he got himself this new hi-fi equipment, and he said, "Oh, we're going to get a few people along to hear this this evening." So anyhow, he had a flat somewhere or other, or went along there, and anyhow, he's got this great boom box on the go, and of course, all quite interesting. We're all sitting around and everything like that. So anyhow. Another chap there, and he says, "We haven't got any girls here this evening." And anyhow, one of them said, "Oh, I know a couple of girls." So anyhow, she went off, who lived in the same block of flats, and anyhow, she came back with two other girls. And anyhow, I was sitting there, and anyhow, these two walked in, looking. So anyhow, I thought, "Well, where are they going to sit?" So anyhow, I got up. And anyhow, the first one there, I said, "Oh, well, I'm Paddy Lean." And he said, "Let me find you a place to sit." So anyhow, we sat and listened to the hi-fi for a while, and about a chit-chat and the likes. And anyhow, during the course of the evening, I thought, "Well, you seem pretty smart kind of a person." And anyhow, I managed to get her phone number from her. So anyhow, that's what started it all. Yeah.
The rest was history.
Yeah,
fascinating insight into what life was like in Rhodesia, now called, of course, Zimbabwe.
You're listening to the Saturday Supplement with Joe McGill on Radio Kerry.
Now let's return to the interview with William Lean on his book, Finding Rhodesia.
And how long did your military career go on for then?
Well, I actually carried on. The conditions there were quite good. But there was a bit of a major change came up in the army. And there used to be a real gap in the way the army finances were handled. And they now, as part of the overall logistics effort, they formed a pay corps. And anyhow, they're now advertising for people who could become officers. I wasn't an officer at the time, I was a warrant officer. And I thought, well, hang on, it seems to be quite an interesting life. I must say that working on the leadership side was very exacting. Hours were very long. I had to start work in the mornings, 7 o'clock every morning. Sometimes I might be away from home for 3 or 4 days at the time and the likes. But anyhow, I applied for consideration and I got accepted. And I then got appointed as a paymaster, and they had another, and paymaster and frontline cashier or something like that. I can't remember what the thing was. And of course, I got moved up to Northern Rhodesia because there I there was a major station up there where they had a lot of problems with their own finances and the likes. And of course, also they brought in a new system there whereby African soldiers now they had to be paid every 2 weeks. So anyhow, that was how I got started there. And then on top of that, I had various duties on the go for acquiring local supplies and the likes as well. But anyhow, that was very interesting. Anyhow, there were a lot of developments going on down through the years. That was a bit of a lonely place for a while. It was a bit hard on my wife, although our first child was over a year old at the time and the second one was on the way. But it was, kind of a lonely place. There were only about maybe 12 or 14 Europeans there. Anyhow, we had our own separate areas of living. And there was a major political move at the time, and that was the Federation of Central Africa was going to be brought to an end, yeah. So when that happened, they had all kinds of schemes on the go. And one of the things that I had an offer of, because now the British Army are going to take over the operation of all these African battalions other than Rhodesia, because Rhodesia was not going to join the same kind of an organization as all the others were. And I had an offer to go to the British Army here, and I really thought very hard about this, and I thought, on a chance, how could I survive in this industrialized country with all this open spaces around here and the like? So anyhow, I decided to stay there. So anyhow, I came back to Rhodesia, and I then had quite a successful career there in various places. And of course, the thing was, in those days, there was a compulsory pension scheme, and of course, the conditions of service were that you could get a pension after 20 years, which was roughly 40% of your existing pay. And I thought, well, I can't just think that I'm going to try and carry on forever. Some people used to stay in the army for as long as they possibly could. But anyhow, I started thinking what I wanted to do, and started going to night classes to learn a few things about commerce and accounting, commercial law, auditing, and various things like that. And I was quite successful in that. So eventually, when my 20 years had finished, I left. And I then, at the time, was offered a job with a major conglomerate, and actually that was really on the transport side of them, container transport operations. And I joined those, and I set up what was called a container park. Containerization had come in at the time as well, because sanctions had now been lifted in various ways, and trade was mostly in containers. It just was a real development in international trading. And when these containers, they would come in loaded with goods, and then when they were empty, they had to be parked somewhere. So we opened up what was called a container park, where we're now just a vacant piece of land, which we organised in certain ways. And anyhow, we looked after people's containers there. We used to charge them a parking fee for them. But at the same time, we used to make sure they were cleaned. If they were damaged in any way, we would repair them. And then we had a minor transport fleet for carting them around as well to pick up goods in other places. So anyhow, that became quite a successful operation and gave me a kind of a good name, and I found myself then with further promotion. And eventually we consolidated our transport fleet in quite a big way. So anyhow, eventually, as part of that operation, I had a responsibility for a transport fleet of about 130 vehicles, which was something quite big. And although then again, most of them were out on long-term leases to other organisations, as it were, but there was the financial aspect and, of course, the repair aspect of them. But anyhow, that was quite a busy setup. And anyhow, I made a fair bit of a name for myself there, and I got promotion again.
The Saturday Supplement with Joe McGill on Radio Kerry.
Welcome along to the second hour of the programme. I'm Joe McGill. Now, we are, of course, talking to William Lean, who was born in Tralee, the son of a member of An Garda Síochána. And at 18 years, he worked in Ulster Bank in London, then applied to go to Rhodesia at the age of 78. He returned to live here in Ireland in 2008, first in Dublin and now in Carrigaveen. And I went to visit him just outside Carrigaveen in Clahan Linehan about his life. So let's return to the interview I did with him now. I'm trying to think about this. It's so far away from here. And did you ever get the opportunity, you know, in the early years to even come back, or how would you correspond back, or how did that work?
Oh, no, I don't know. I came back a few times, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Did you get to bring your young family back?
Oh, yes, I did, yeah. Well, I only brought my son back. My wife came back with me a couple of times, and actually, matter of fact, we did a fair bit of touring because I had quite a family in North America as well that I hadn't seen for many years. And anyhow, on one particular occasion, we had quite a major trip where Gerard, my son, who is now a bit mature, and Saida and myself, we went off, and we went to Toronto, where my sister was, from there to Winnipeg, where my brother was. From there to San Francisco, where my sister was, and then back to Toronto before we came back to Ireland again, before we came back to Rhodesia, I should say. And I mean, on one occasion, Thalia and myself, we had a very interesting trip around Ireland. Well, you know, I took her to where I went to school, where I lived up in Donegal, where I came from down in Kerry, and anyhow, really showed her something about Ireland. So anyhow, she was very intrigued with Ireland. And anyhow, no, I had quite a lot of contact with my family.
You were lucky in that you had the means to do it as well.
Because, yeah, make no mistake, I was well paid, and yeah. Anyhow, and of course at the time I was involved in various other operations, which led me doing official visits to, like, one was an organisation called PACA, and you read there about how I managed to organise with them to set up an assembly plant for their vehicles in Zimbabwe, and then also with Cummins Engine Corporation, we also had an operation for them there. And the idea was that you know, they would help us to get these places set up, and then, you know, we would use local staff to develop them. And anyhow, unfortunately, the PACA one came unstuck, which I describe in the book. But anyhow, that was because of political agitation going on, and also nothing. Do you know what a kleptocracy is? In other words, kleptocracies, where everything evolves around stealing, yeah. Klepto is the Greek for steal, yeah.
Yeah, like kleptomania, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah. There you are.
Yeah.
But anyhow, the these are some of the things that now start causing problems in the countryside, as it were.
They're in the book, and it's so sad. Your wife, she dies relatively young.
She did,
yeah, she passed away. That was
70. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a massive traumatic event for you. You know, for you and your children.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very much so. Yeah. But then again, you just have to get on with life, and that's all there's to it. Yeah.
Is that your attitude in general to life? To get on with it. Is that kind of the army training in you? You think?
I suppose it could be. Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, yeah. I suppose in the army, maybe you become a bit too familiar with death. But anyhow, that's another story. Yeah, anyhow. And that was a terrible blow. But anyhow, I just got on with life and carried on with what I was doing.
How did it come about then that you came back to Ireland?
How?
Yeah.
Well, the there was a major deterioration in the overall security aspect. And now, when I finished with the army in 1974, okay, and that's when I started my career with TA Holdings. And unfortunately, I was on the reserve of officers, and unfortunately I got recalled off the reserve and put back into uniform, yeah. And I was given the job of straightening out a very difficult problem. And unfortunately, in amongst that, I thought I had a heart attack, and that was that was where I what happened was, I didn't feel at all well on one occasion, and I was up in what they call the operational area at the time. So anyhow, I came back, I went to see the doctor, and the doctor said, "I'm not happy with you," he said. "I want you to go and have an ECG." So anyhow, I went and had an ECG, and the nurse in the said to me, "Well, hang on, there's an irregularity there." And anyhow, our ruling is when we see any of that, people have to be admitted into hospital. I said, "Well, I can't be admitted into hospital. I've got to go to work." But anyhow, I did finish off in hospital for a while. And I had visits from various cardiologists and things like that, but you know, in the end, thing was, well, whatever my problem was, I didn't have a heart attack, which was a great relief as far as I was concerned. At that time, I now reached the age of 50, and I had to go on to the reserve of officers. Okay, so in other words, I had to finish off with the army at the time. Anyhow, that was then when I started my career with the TA Group, and down through the years, that led me also. Oh, sorry, with them, I had to retire at 65 from them, yeah. And anyhow, I must say I did very well there, because I also got another pension from them. And at that stage, because of developments in the country involving the Southern African Development Community, which was an effort in Southern Africa to try and emulate what was happening in the European Union. Anyhow, because of my knowledge of the thing overall, I got appointed as the Zimbabwe representative for the transport sector there. And of course, that led me to a lot of different liaison with other governments, with border crossings and things like that, which was very, very rewarding. But unfortunately, in amongst all this lot, I did one hell of a lot of travelling on occasion. I always say the longest trip I ever did was from 5 o'clock in the morning until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I travelled just on 1,200 kilometres down through the central part of Africa. Yeah. Anyhow, that was when the doctor said to me, "Look, you are developing a cardiac problem called atrial fibrillation, and your heart is out of sync, as it were." And he said, "I'm not sure what you need, but you can't get any treatment for that here. You have to go to South Africa for it." And anyhow, he said, "Well, that's no great problem. I'll sort it out for you." He said, "But the deposit for it is $50,000 US. I didn't have $50,000 US. And anyhow, when I really had a good hard look at things, now, at the time, there was a hell of a deterioration going on again because of kleptocracy, where, you know, the new African government is now getting in. This guy Mugabe is really getting his own Mugabenomics, as they called it, on the go, and most of that evolved around kleptocracy. And anyhow, the this situation was obviously being monitored in a quiet way by the Irish government, who knew that the Irish people in Zimbabwe were now not in a very good position. So anyhow, he sent out a circular to different people, not published or anything like that. And because I was known there, I got a copy of it, and they said there that the government has decided that if any Irish person could not afford for medical attention in Zimbabwe, then they will get that medical attention in Ireland free of charge. Yeah. And that, of course, evolved around other things as well. So anyhow, when I had a good hard look at this, I didn't have any option anyway. And the doctor said to me, "Look, you can't leave this thing hanging around for too long." And anyhow, in the meantime, I've been for various other medical exams and things like this. And the atrial fibrillation was actually something new. And he said to me, "In all probability, you probably need a pacemaker." So anyhow, I came back to Ireland. Eventually, I found myself fixed up with a pacemaker, which more or less has eased my problem in many ways since. Yeah.
What year was that?
2008.
Okay, and you're back since?
Yeah.
Yeah, William has some head on his shoulders. The memory he has is absolutely outstanding, that he can think back that far and with such clarity and of such detail. It was mesmerizing to hear him recount his life story when I visited him.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry.
Now let's return to the interview I did with William Lean over the water on his book, Finding Rhodesia. How did this book come about? Why did you decide to write it? You left it long enough, 92 years of age.
Oh, I think it was Mary who...
Your daughter now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think with my son, I was doing quite a lot of delving into my family history. In other words, who my predecessors were and where they came from, where my grandfather came from, everything like that. And a fair amount of that I now recorded it all and sent it out to other members of the family and the likes. And then I passed a fair bit of it to to Mary also, and so with George, who gave me, he's very good on genealogy. And anyhow, he said, you know, you should write a book. And I thought to myself, well, let me give it a go. Well, of course, once I started, that kind of egged me on, and I kept going, yeah. And it took me 3 to 4 months, yeah. I've forgotten that it took me a long time anyway, make no mistake, because in longhand, and because my writing wasn't very good, I had to print it, you know, in capital letters, you might say. And in all, I wrote, I think it was 146 pages.
And this was during lockdown, wasn't it? It was COVID.
Yeah, part of, yeah.
So I suppose, like, COVID became a positive thing for you, really.
Well, it did, yeah, because, I mean, I couldn't go out. I was kind of cocooned, you might say. So anyhow, I just cocooned myself with a pen and paper, anyhow. So anyhow, that's what happened. And anyhow, the various ways then... Oh, that's right. Mary got hold of some young girl somewhere who typed the whole thing, and that started it. And anyhow, the next thing I know is that Mary had been to a publisher and actually produced the book. So anyhow, there it was, yeah.
You must be very proud looking at it, because it actually looks... wonderful as well. It's a stunning front cover as well.
Yeah.
But you must be very proud of yourself to get it done. And you know, I know there's a famous author over the road from us here in Ballinskeddix, Michael Kirby, Mihalo Kirvig. He started his artistic and writing life in his 80s and did it all the way up to he was 98.
With you.
Yeah. So like it is something that more people should be doing, isn't it? You know.
Well,
you know.
It is. Yeah. Anyhow, I suppose I thought to myself, well, I must leave it some kind of a notification to my children what I did in life, and maybe show them what you can do if you get yourself properly organised and make sure you have get yourself qualified in some way or another for the commercial world in which we live, yeah. But anyhow, it was a long haul, and I have to thank Mary. She's the one who actually decided that it was something that might be of interest to other people as well. But anyhow, there it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a few philosophical questions for you, but before I ask you those, tell us, we haven't really mentioned your children. What are their names?
Gerard is Gerard William Anthony Lean. That's his full name. And anyhow, you've seen him. He's here. And anyhow, he had a good upbringing. He actually started off in life as an electronics technician, and the company he worked for came unstuck. Anyhow, I saw an advert in the Irish Times advertising a course for people who might be interested in what was basically genealogy, you might say, or something like that. So anyhow, I put his name forward and he got accepted. And anyhow, he then went to that course, which was conducted in town. Anyhow, that more or less started him. And then, of course, he realised he'd like to get himself a little bit further organised, and with a lot of effort and a lot of it on his bicycle, he actually went to Maynooth University, where he got a BA, and then he went up back afterwards and got himself an MA. So, anyhow, he still works on the genealogy side, yeah.
Mm.
But just tell you my other two children. Marion Cooksley, she's actually an accountant, and she and a friend, they run a very successful operation making cigarettes in Zimbabwe at the moment. And then my daughter Jackie, she and her husband, they emigrated to South Africa going back many years ago. And after various fits and starts, doing certain things and the likes. Eventually they acquired a light engineering company, and their main product are hose clips. Yeah, but anyhow, it's a really highly special one in that they only produce them in stainless steel. And of course then they produce hose clips, as I say, the smallest one is a little one you put your finger through, and the biggest one I think has got a diameter of I think it's 1.2 metres or something like that, which is used in irrigation schemes and the likes. Whoa. Anyhow, yeah. And then on top of that they make various other minor electrical goods and various things as well. In other words, anyhow, make no mistake, they have a very good business. And anyhow, Jackie, she's got three children, and anyhow, they've done well for themselves. All three of them went to university, and one of them, who's married, as a result of which I became a great-grandfather not so long ago. So anyhow, they're doing quite well, and anyhow, her son, one son, Richard, he works in the UK for a public relations company, and no, it's a marketing company actually. And then Stuart, he's a real whiz on computers and all kinds of other things, and he has just finished a degree in the university in South Africa in computer science. Yeah. So anyhow,
you're proud of them all?
Oh yeah, very much so. Oh yeah.
What's the secret to your long life, do you think?
My secret of life is number one, to stay healthy. I have always exercised quite a bit. I mean, in the the habit of being out in the bush on continuous basis, and you know, when I came back to Ireland, I realised I had to be fit. So anyhow, I got myself a bicycle, and I used to, in my heyday, I used to ride a bicycle for an hour every morning before breakfast. I used to had a circuit, which I did roughly 10 miles, in an hour. And anyhow, down through the years, I had to cut that down a bit, but unfortunately I had another problem in recent years, and now I get a bit breathless now and again, so I'm not very good at walking at the moment. Yeah. But anyhow, I kept myself as fit as I could do, and one of the greatest things in life, I never smoked. Yeah, I never smoked, and I don't drink very much or anything like that. So in other words, I eat properly, and in that way I just live a normal life and hope for the best. And every morning when I wake up, I look on every day as a bonus. Yeah.
You seem to me like a man that wants to keep busy as well.
Oh yes, very much so. Well, look, at the moment I do everything for myself. I do my own cooking, I do my own housework, and so on. And these are the kind of things that keep you going. And I don't walk as much as I would like to, yeah. But as Mary says, when I was writing the book, I disciplined myself and I used to walk about 2 or 3 kilometres every day down the road and back again. But anyhow, that kind of kept me going. But anyhow, that's what it is.
And finally, this area, you know, the cocooning was a horrible word that was being used there, and people had to cocoon. Yeah. But there isn't many nicer places than here to be cocooned, is there?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Oh, make no mistake about that, yeah. No, that was really good, yeah. Anyhow, I survived, yeah.
Thanks a million for inviting me here, and thanks a million for telling me your story, and congratulations. It's a great publication, and it's very impressive, the amount of detail. I'd recommend anyone to read it. Thanks for talking to me, and continued success, and thanks for welcoming me here.
Thank you, and all the best to you for the future.
William Lean there, and I want to thank William and Mary Casey as well for inviting me over, William's daughter-in-law, over the water to do that interview. And I wish him all continued success. They haven't launched the book as of yet, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they will do with. They have published a few copies, but I'm looking forward to seeing what they'll, like I said, what they'll do with it, because it's a very interesting book, and well done to him, and well done to all involved in it as well.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry.
So it is the second Saturday of the month, so that means it's time for our Kerry County Council Creative Kingdom, where we let you know what's going on in the arts and culture world around this county. And my God, is there a lot of things happening and have happened over the last few weeks. Kate Kennelly, Arts Officer with Kerry County Council, is with me. Kate, how did Culture Night go? A raging success, I hear.
Joe, it was, and I'd like to say a very big thank you to all the participants. We had so many organisers, artists, my own team here in the office, in particular Hannah, my Assistant Arts Officer, who led on a lot of the programming and coordination, and the whole team. You've Caroline, Megan, Morel and Sean all helped out, so there was a lot of work behind the scenes, but all the people who delivered, it was fantastic, Joe. I mean, we always have a good culture night, to be fair, but this was just, it was brilliant. Now, we had extra funding this year, which really helped, because we could commission bigger acts and bigger projects and programming, which was all fantastic. So I suppose to date, the feedback we've got in terms, over 90 artists, Joe, and performers were paid on the night, which is brilliant, because it's supporting the sector, which is what it should be doing as well. And we've 3,500 attendees to date, and we're still waiting for some numbers to come back from some certain areas. One of the things, I was in Killarney and going around to everything, and this one lady said to me at the end of the night, "I've seen you at a lot of things. I've had a great culture night. I usually go to culture night in X, we'll say, because she's from there. This is way better." She said, "I'm going to come back here next year." And she was making the point that the city she's from, a lot of the good events are booked out very quickly, and that you can't always get into things. Whereas she got to go to everything she wanted to go to in Killarney, which was fantastic. Like from poetry to painting to music to dance, exhibitions, the works. It was a great night altogether. And Tralee, of course. Tralee just stole the show with Firestorm. You had the Kerry International Film Festival outdoor screening. You had the Awaken Mabon, Awaken Youth, Seamus of the Museum. And then a few other people stole the show. Turin Cahill had an amazing night, full house. Knocknagoshal as well, super theatre performance. And over in Ardfert, the Michael Cavan exhibition, which was organised by the Ardfert Historical Society. Would you believe it? Two people from Nashville came to see it. So, you know, we're hearing great things back. And I know you'll have Jessica on in a minute, who had a lovely event as well for Culture Night. So, Joe, just thank you to everyone. And we couldn't do it without the sponsors. So the Arts Council, this year, the Local Live Performance Support Scheme, Creative Ireland programme, as well as Kerry County Council, and everyone who rolls up the sleeves and gets involved. I don't know if you made it down to the events in South Kerry. We had great feedback. Someone sent me some footage on the phone of someone singing a lovely Irish song. And, you know, it was just a magic night, Joe, for anyone who was out at it.
Yeah, I was speaking to Holger Lonza, the sculptor, and he had a great evening as well. And even for the people participating themselves that, you know, put on the events, it's great for them as well. They really enjoyed it. So well done to everyone involved. And I can't believe it's over now, but we still have lots more to talk about on the programme. And I was lucky enough to go to this production and play during the year, Hunger Strike. It's on in Killorgan. It was absolutely amazing, and it's on again by popular demand. And I'm delighted to say, to tell us more, we have theatre historian and author Fiona Brennan. Fiona, you're very welcome. You must be very excited.
Very, very excited. You know, the cast are, I mean, they were working through summer to make sure that they were still on top of the script and everything. So the play is on opening on Thursday, the October 13th. It's running Friday night and also Saturday. So the 13th, 14th and 15th, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night in the CYNS in Killorgan. And we're very excited, Joe.
Excellent. So briefly, just tell people what the play is about. This play, I went to it, it's full of humour, but it's full of emotion, and it's very historical as well.
Absolutely. So it's being presented by Killorgan Archive Society, and it's one of our, I suppose, central events of the Decade of Centenaries programme that we're running this year and next year. It's by a Killorgan native, Her name was Maureen Cregan, and she was married to one of the co-founders of Fianna Fáil, James Ryan. And she's not very well known as a playwright. She was well known as a children's author. But she wrote this play, Hunger Strike, Civil War play based on the hunger strikes of 1923. And it's based on hers and her husband James' real life experiences. And what's absolutely wonderful about it, she has actually based it on a lot of the correspondence that was between them from during 1923. It's set in Kerry, and it's based around the story of a lady called Nan O'Grady, and her husband is on hunger strike in a Dublin prison. And as the play opens, he's been on hunger strike for 25 days. And the play brings up everything that, I suppose, the controversy around the Civil War, and even looking at it 100 years later, talking about suicide, talking about the church's attitude towards it, and how Nana was absolutely torn. And her family is split. She is anti-treaty, obviously, and she is trying to deal with her brother and her aunt, who are pro-treaty, and trying to force her to ask her husband Ned to come off strike. And so it's, I suppose, as well as those themes around it, as it's based in Kerry, it's written, the dialogue and everything is absolutely beautifully written. And as you were saying, Joe, you know, very, very serious themes. But Maureen, being from Kerry and basing the play on, I suppose, the Kerry dialogue and setting it outside of Tralee, it's full of witticisms and great humour as well. And the characters are extremely well formed. And there was an incredible reaction to it last March. Now, we were meant to put it on for 5 nights last March, but COVID got us, so we put it on for 2, and due to popular demand, as you were saying, it's back on. And also, the cast were extremely eager, and the production team, to put it on again, because they know how important this is to our history, and yeah, that it's a story that deserves to be told.
Yeah, definitely deserves to be told. It's an excellent production. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. Wonderful, talented cast and production behind it as well. If people want to go, do they just rock up on the night, or can you buy tickets beforehand, or how does it work?
They can try rocking up in the night, absolutely no problem. But demand is very, very high. We're delighted with bookings at the minute. But if you want to secure your seats, it's on the CYMS Hall, Culloden, October 13th, 14th, 15th. That's Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights. You can book at 066-976-2053. And that's available online at the CYMS Hall, Culloden website as well. Tickets are €15, and I would urge everyone to come and see it for an absolutely extremely strong production.
Excellent. Fiona Brennan, for now, thanks a million for coming on. You will be back on the Saturday Supplement again, where we'll be talking about Sigis and Clifford, so I'm looking forward to that. But for now, best of luck with the production, and thanks for coming on. Tell
thanks
us all about
so
it.
Thanks so much, Joe. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Now let's go to Cormac O'Mahony, who's the chairperson of the Patrick O'Keefe Traditional Music Festival. Cormac, how are you?
Very good, Joe. Delighted to be on. Get a chance to promote the festival.
Yeah, and it's coming up. Tell us, when is it on and what should we expect?
It's on the October bank holiday weekend, the Halloween weekend, the last weekend in the month. And this year we're going out to a five-day event. So we're starting on the Thursday. And the first event is going to be on Torres Moor, putting on a fire show in Library Place. It's at 7 o'clock in the evening. And then session trail starts on Thursday. And then Friday we get into the kind of nuts and bolts of sessions and concerts and recitals. So we have a concert Friday night in the River Island Hotel with Seamus Begley and Teda, and support by Greta Curtin and Jesse Healy. Then sessions in all the bars around the town. Then Saturday we have at 11 o'clock in the morning we have classes and all the traditional instruments. Now all the details on the website, I won't go through individual teachers and whatnot, but they're all there. And there is, I think there's about 15 different classes for different levels of players, from relative beginners to accomplished players. And then at 2 o'clock we have the Kerry Fiddles Sleeve Local Recital, which is a fiddle concert, but we're focusing on the Kerry Fiddles album that was recorded in 1952 by Dennis Murphy and Julie Clifford. And that'll be in the River, or in the I Believe Arts Centre. And we have again a big list of participating fiddle players, and last month edition was Frankie Gavin, who's playing in that as well. Then at 4 o'clock on Saturday we have a singing concert with Mirny Olive and Barry Kerr, our own Mickey McConnell and Tim Dennehy. And that night then we have the Sleeve Lucre 30th anniversary concert, which has been supported by the Kerry County Council Local Life Performance Programme Scheme. And thank you to Kate and Merle there for their help and support for this. And that features all the local, kind of the greats of local sleep local music, and in 30 years of the festival is the focus of it. And we are also giving out that we give out an award every year for dedication to this musical Sleep Lucre, an adult award. We're saying it's going to Mara O'Keefe this year for her great work collecting the music of Sleep Lucre. And then we had a competition for young musicians, which we had a female and a male under 18, and the female was a lady came all the way from Donegal. Megan McGinley is coming down to play, and the male side of it was Sean Butler, all men from Scarton Lynn. So that's a nice connection there. That is Saturday. Then Sunday we have a junior trad session in the afternoon at 12:30, for all kind of levels, from more or less beginners onwards, but say all underage players are welcome to that one. And it's been hosted by Emma O'Leary and Maura O'Connor. Then we have lectures at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We have three mini lectures, kind of half hour lectures, from one of Tom Billy Murphy by Raymond O'Sullivan. We have 30 years of Patrick Keefe Festival Reflection by Peter Brown, a festival founder, the RT Peter Brown, who presented the Rolling Wave. And then we have Sleeve Lucre, a view from across the pond. Patrick Kavanagh is in from the USA. He's very much involved in traditional music in America, and he's giving a lecture on the effect of Sleeve Lucre music in America. And so, 4 o'clock.
Yeah, and just running out of time, so just briefly, okay. Finally.
Okay, album launches on Sunday afternoon. Concert Sunday night again, Formula and Dog with lots of supporting acts. There's a Kaylee on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock with Donny Nolan, another one on the Monday with Johnny Reedy. There's a pop up Gaeltacht. There's a second, there's an open singing session with Mikey Connor and Joe Walsh. All welcome. So it's kind of full on all weekend. There's music, there's events, it's constantly happening. So there's something for everyone.
Excellent. More information, where can people go?
If you Google Patrick Keefe Festival, it's all on the website, you know.
I love to hear that, yes, because if you just Google these, you'll find all the info. That's
it's
brilliant.
All there, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what an action-packed weekend it is. Yeah, amazing.
Musicians from all over the world. They have flying in from America, they come in from Japan, they come from England, they come from all over the world. So it's a great event, you know, and a great event for local people to come out and hear different styles of music and meet different people, you know.
Yes, and support your local festival. Absolutely true. Yeah. Cormac, thanks a million for coming on. It's on the October Bank Holiday weekend, and go and support that wonderful festival. Great work goes on behind the scenes there. Now let's go Jessica Courtney Lean of West End House in Killarney. Jessica, you've some very interesting acting classes coming up. Tell us about those.
We do indeed, Joe. Thanks a million for having me on. Just to add on to what Kate was saying, we had a great culture night. We had three taster classes on the night. We had acting for screen, we had introduction to acting, and then we had finding your voice, which is the class that kind of focuses on helping people, you know, come out of their shell a little bit more, build an ensemble, work together as a team, and just find their own voice, which is great. So we had a great time on culture night. We have all of our acting classes are underway at the moment, so they started a week ago. So we have screen acting for teens, we have screen acting for adults. Those are sold out at the moment, so I feel bad saying that now, but there's a few other classes that we have a couple of places still left in, but there's still quite a large group there. We have one class that's yet to start, so if people are listening and they're thinking of giving it a go, it's the perfect class for that. It's acting with Charlie Hughes. Charlie is one of our fantastic teachers that we have in the school, and it begins an 8-week adult acting program on Wednesday, October 14th, and that's a 2-hour class every week from 7 until 9, and it's absolutely perfect for, we have people all the time saying, you know, I've no background in drama, or I don't want to, you know, go to Hollywood or anything like that, but I'd love to try something out, and I'd love to, you know, make friends and have something to do one day a week, and you know, explore my creativity. So it's the perfect class for that, and there's still places left that people do want to join, and we purposely kind of left that later so that people could just have a look around the website and just think about what they want to do. And so yeah, that's there, and we'd love to see newcomers obviously this year. And other than that, yeah, we're just rocking away at all the classes.
Yeah, and how have you been finding it, you know, like during the pandemic to now, has it changed much for you?
We started September 2021, which was last year, and we began initially going into the local schools, which was always Michael and Tony's vision to work with the schools, and that's the priority, to give the, you know, the kids classes in drama, something that wasn't there years ago. And it was always the aim then to have them coming to us after Christmas once the building was open, and that's where we're at now. And it's brilliant. Like, the only difference between last September and now is the fact that we're in the building, and also the COVID masks are gone, which is great, obviously, because you're expressive and you're, you know, looking at people's facial expressions when you're acting. It was all very doable still, and it's interesting. You know, we did a lot of workshops online during COVID. And it's a problem in theatre is something brilliant, because you have to find a solution. So it's something that we just learn to work with, but we're delighted to be.
Yeah, I love to hear that as well, the class, you know, that it's not just about being Hollywood stars. And we do have them here in this county with Michael Fassbender and Jesse Buckley and so many more. But it is great for people's confidence and communication ability. And it can almost change your life in a way, like acting classes like that, can't it? To give you that confidence.
It can, and a lot of, you know, we've international students coming over from Italy and from the States. We've got a group now in October from Italy and in January from America. And a lot of the feedback that we got from last year, and again, equally from the schools, from the kids and adult classes, is that exact thing that, you know, they came into the class kind of thinking, oh, I don't know, is this for me? And after even just 1 week, just feeling more themselves. It's not even that we're trying to mold them into any kind of performer. It's that they discover parts of themselves and their own voice, and exactly like you said, confidence, and just trusting your gut. And I suppose that's such a crucial thing that you learn in theatre school, that you just have to learn to go with your gut. And it's a great life lesson, and to trust your own voice and your instincts and
things. It is, Joe. I think you and I should be signing up for that Wednesday class. What do you think?
Yeah, I tell you, I'm mulling it over here. I think it's a great idea. I think it's fantastic.
We'll carpool. Just one thing I want to say, it was great when Minister Foley as well announced earlier in the year that she was bringing film and drama onto the curriculum for, you know, post-junior cert classes. I thought it's going to be a game changer for so many people. And as Jessica said, it's about finding your voice and the confidence to communicate. Now, Joe, you might believe this, but I wouldn't say boo to a cat in school. I was very shy altogether, and it took years of being in the public domain and having to speak to be comfortable with it, you know. But I think it's great. The younger people can start and to be confident and to express themselves, and drama and creativity, all that is so important. So having the West End School of Acting and Theatre and Arts is just amazing for Killarney and for the county. And as Jessica said, people coming in from across the world. And, you know, we spoke about Culture Night, and I got video footage this morning from Catherine Young about the event in Tralee with the asylum seekers and refugees. So it was a Kaylee with African dance, Middle Eastern dance, Ukrainian dance. And to see the joy on people's faces as they come together, and people spoke about what they've been through and how this night gave them such a respite. So, you know, we can't underestimate the power of arts and culture in our own lives. And I think everyone needs it today. The world has been through an awful lot and is going through an awful lot. There's a lot of uncertainty, and where we can give joy and bring a sense of confidence and self and communication, it's so important.
Yeah, excellent. Well said, Kate. Jessica, I'm just looking at images here of West End House School of the Arts. It looks very welcoming and a beautiful kind of a setting there as well. If people want more information on you, where can they go?
Yeah, so I just advise anyone who's interested in anything just to keep an eye on the website, westendhouse.ie, and we also have Instagram and Facebook, and you can kind of find us there most days of the week posting something or other. And it's just, yeah, it's a lovely way to keep in touch with what we're doing, and we love to hear from students and prospective students as well. So, yeah.
Well, fantastic. Jessica, Courtney, Lean, thanks a million for coming on and talking to us this morning. Best of luck with it.
Thanks, Joe.
You're listening to the Saturday Supplement with Joe McGill on Radio Kerry.
It is the second Saturday of the month, and that means it is our Kerry County Council Creative Kingdom. And Arts Officer with Kerry County Council, Kate Kennelly, is still with us. Kate, lots more happening this month, I'd imagine, and going forward.
There is, and we've had so much already. And just to say, you know, big congratulations, Joe, as well, to the Patrick O'Keefe Festival Committee. They do amazing work. And as Cormac said, people come in from across the world. I was there a few years ago, and there was a number of people from America, and they'd come specially for the festival. So you can't underestimate the importance of our living culture as well, and its attraction, you know, so that's really important. Just to give a shout out, I suppose, the National Circus Festival of Ireland will be coming up from the 3rd to the 6th of November. And as you know, it's an amazing festival. the brainchild of our own Con Horrigan of the Fanzinis, and it's 21 years, would you believe, this year. That's just bananas, but it is, it's 21 years. So the festival favourites of Circus Shimsta and the festival Renegade stage are going to be on, and they have a brand new tumble circus, and there's a big top. So they're inviting people to finish off the midterm break in style and to join them at the National Circus Festival of Ireland. So all the details will be online, Joe, at circusfestival.ie. And outside of that, we'll be in November, we'll have the Dingle Lit Festival and many more. So I'll be back to you next month on that. But please, just to encourage your listeners to go to our social media, it's arts@kerrycoco.ie for the email, but it's Facebook and Twitter @kerrycoarts if they want to keep up to date with everything. It's all there.
Excellent, absolutely fantastic. Just I was just thinking about the what you mentioned about the Patrick O'Keefe Festival. Them festivals are so important to bring that outside visitor in, and now that we can do that again, it is vital. And I'd say all these festivals have got an added shot in the arm again, because they are able to, you know, put on these wonderful events again, have people come, and those people that might have been watching on Zoom a few years ago are now visiting in person.
Completely. And you know, late October, you're talking about, you're well into the shoulder season there, so it's not the peak tourist season, and it's a great time to promote your cultural tourism, because your cultural tourist traditionally is an all season, all weather traveller, and they are a high yield tourist traditionally as well, so they're, you know, the more they come to Kerry, the better. But in terms of the festival, you can hear the passion, you know, and the commitment, and also just the breadth of musicians they can pull from, and the support from the schools, the local community. And I mean, Patrick O'Keefe Festival, it's a key aspect of the whole Shuvlucra Music Trail. Without themselves, the Handed Down series, World Fiddle Day, and the Concurrent Festival, you know, we wouldn't have a Shuvlucra Music Trail. So hats off to them all, and I wish them every success.
Excellent. Well, we're already looking forward to next month again. I can't get over how quickly this month has gone, but we'll be heading in towards the kind of, dare I say it, the Christmas period as well. So it is a kind of a busy period for another reason then as well, Kate. But if people again want more information on all these wonderful events we've been speaking about this morning, where can they go?
Yeah, so they can email us in, or they can go to our social media @KerryCoArts. And if they want to be subscribed to our free e-newsletter, just to email into arts@kerrycoco.ie, and we'll sign them up. And it's a free newsletter. It would come into your inbox every 2 weeks, and there's loads of information about events, opportunities and so on. And, you know, things are going well, Joe. It's been busy. We've had additional funding support this year, as you know, through the local live performance support scheme. That wraps up the end of October. But Morelle collated some information for me there, and I mean, you know, you're talking about close to 200 people in Kerry have been supported through that scheme, and again over 140 events. So it's been really important. So we'll wait and see what the new year will bring, but we're hopeful that there'll be plenty of support for the sector moving forward.
Excellent. Kate, already looking forward to speaking to you next month, but for now, thanks a million for coming on and telling us all about those wonderful events.
Thanks, Joe. See you soon.
That's it for this morning's programme. My thanks to Abigail Bernard, who was on sound. And I'll be back again next Saturday at 9 a.m. Until then, look after yourself and take care.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry.